Bitcoin Real 4. We were talking about your training, well, crew training with, we don't know which one, but the training regiment, the Royal Armoured Corps at Barnard Castle in mid-43. And what about the chairman's general characteristics? I mean, what did you think of it before you went into action as a tank? I mean, it had a bigger gun, you've mentioned. What about armour, the engine, just generally as a tank?
In general terms, because you've come from a Valentine, which with its very vast engine and small gun and compact tank, the Sherman team is that much bigger all around in general terms. It was wider, heavier, higher, which is not really much of an advantage. But it was impressive. When you compared it what you'd been dealing with before, in fact, the had like white enamel inside, so it was quite nicely finished in some ways. Your periscopes you could change if your lenses outside got blown away, you could change them from the inside. Little features that you don't take too much notice of, but when you think about them, you feel that that was done right.
What about the gun was better, but not as good as the sort of things that the Germans had. Were you aware at the time of what, say, the German tanks had on board?
Not really. You had tank recognition sort of thing, and from the silhouettes and that you saw, you realised that the Panther had a bigger gun than the Sherman. In silhouette form, you had no idea that it could outgun the Sherman in distance, because the Sherman is like a lobbing, a small barrel, it's like a howitzer, it lobs, where the German fire was flat trajectory virtually.
And which was better? Oh, we'll come to this, bro.
Yeah, we'll come to that.
Now, the other thing is armour, because was there a noticeable difference in British armour, as in the Valentine and lots of British tanks, and the sort of German type of Sherman type of armour?
You had very little to compare it to. It all seemed good. It all seemed adequate. It curves to sort of deflect, and a turret ring, protection ring, which, by the look of it, looked quite adequate. It wasn't until later that you realised it wasn't. But
some people said it was softer and visibly a sort of, you could tell it was softer.
It was a softer metal. British armour seemed to be hardened to a degree. This was cast, I guess, most of this. But I don't think the impact of it really had any great effect on you in those days, in the early stages. They also had grants. We had grants there as well.
What were they like? Well, I don't know the grant at all. What was it like?
It was. It had its main gun alongside in the hull, but it wasn't on a turret, and the actual gun could move 11 degrees. I think was the magic word. 11 degrees. That's all the angle you had. So initially you had to aim the tank first and then the gun afterwards. So it was used in the desert probably. I don't think it was ever used in Normandy or the like, but it was certainly used in the desert. And then I had a turret with a small gun on the top of that, in the turret.
And what did you think of that one?
Well, that was big. That really was big inside there. Really was. You had the feeling you could walk about, you know. But we only took it out on the ranges, and you didn't do a lot of work in it, but it was certainly there to be used. But I wasn't over impressed with the gun that you could only move this very small limited amounts that way.
What about the engines and speed of the Sherman and later, perhaps the Krant later?
The Sherman had a variety of engines. And evidently, with typical American sort of know-how, when they decided on the Sherman to what engine to fit with it. They had enormous stocks of six-cylinder car engines in Detroit, I guess, where they were banging these out by the thousand. They had enormous stocks. So somebody had the big idea, they were bolting five of those together, and so you finished up with a 30-cylinder engine with banks, five banks of six cylinders. They drove then through a master drive through a central clutch. So you had 30 cylinders pumping out. A clutch change would have been a nightmare when you think about it, because you had to right down the bottom of the hull. But the very efficient engine. They also had two-stroke diesels, and they were boat engines. They used those. And they were two banks of engines, each with its own clutch, driving another clutch. So you could start them individually on by breaking their own clutch, and then bringing them in, and then you could drive off the main clutch. A bit of a fiddle. And another one had the Wright Cyclone Aero engine, a big air-cooled engine, which I know which problem was with it. Petrol used to blow into the bottom cylinders, so you had to turn it over by hand to start it at the back. That would wind it. But, I mean, a lot of people used to think it was clockwork, you were at the back there winding away, but it was to turn the engine over to get rid of the fuel sitting in the bottom cylinder. There weren't too many of them either.
Which ones did you mainly have then?
The 30-cylinder jobs.
And which was best? I mean, or were they all? Did they all have advantages and disadvantages?
The Wright Cyclone, I didn't spend much time with the aero engine job. I suppose I'd have thought the 30-cylinder one was best, because that's the one I was mostly with.
You had that in France as well later. We'll come back to it, maintenance of it and things, yeah. In France probably. What speed would the Sherman...
You do about 30, 35 at first. Everything in your favour.
And
it depended on the terrain. On good hard surface, concrete surface, you probably get your fair speed up. But on soft, boggy ground, I used to do 2 miles to the gallon.
And what about? Did you have any idea at this time of the Sherman's reputation for catching fire when things went wrong?
No way. Probably just as well, I suppose. No.
So that came later, as far as you were concerned.
That's right, it did.
What about, you were doing crew training. Now, would you go out one day as the gunner and then the next day as the driver and the co-driver, or would you just, you were always gunner?
As a crew, yes, which I'd swap with the operator, the wireless operator from time to time, but it was nearly always in the panic. And the drivers would swap with them. Two drivers would go out and one would be the co-driver and then they'd swap, you know, quite well.
Did you ever get a chance to drive the Sherman at this time?
Yeah.
So you would have a go?
Oh, yeah.
And what was it like to drive?
I used to enjoy it, yeah. I'd drive anything, you know. I'd have a go at anything.
Was it easy to control?
Yeah, it wasn't difficult.
What about turning circles, things like that? I mean,
the Sherman, you really had to pull hard on the stick, and of course you needed power. It was a coordination of putting your foot down for power, the harder you pull back on the stick, because the legs would drop as soon as you put the drag on one side. So you then had to keep them up by giving more power, the harder you pull. But unlike the British tank, they had a good turning circle. The Sherman wasn't as good in that respect. You could literally spin a British tank by one track going one way and the other one going the opposite, and you could virtually spin them like a top. But certainly couldn't do that with the Sherman.
And what about driving? Did you ever get a chance to drive it over obstacles, rough ground, things like that? What was that like?
It was all right for you, but if you were over coming up through a ditch and climbing up to a ridge, if you didn't ease off, you brought the nose down with such a clout that everything came off the back, you know. Because on the wireless, it had the top of the wireless had a gap, so you could stick, in later terms, we used to stick grenades and smoke grenades and all manner of trivia in there. Well, if you brought the nose down heavy, which as it got past the point of pivot, if you brought that down heavy and fast, then all these bits would come flying out. And much to the annoyance of the wireless operator and the like. But,
Was there any... I mean, some people have spoken of them feeling like they were going to tip over when they went over. You know, was that a feeling you ever had?
No.
They're pretty...
When you're going up a bank, you're looking at the sky, you don't see the ground. I mean, you're looking at pure clouds, you know, and gradually, sort of, if you do it right, it comes down nice and gentle. But if you're in a hurry, then...
So if you were in a hurry, it wouldn't have tipped over if you went just over the top. Yeah. And what about sideways... You know,
I never knew one, so I don't know.
So they're a stable platform in that way.
They were quite a good platform, yeah.
And could they actually do things like driving through houses or over trees, things?
Oh, yeah. Low gear, yeah. Yeah, you could. I'm sure you could. Yeah, I mean...
You wouldn't have done that, though. I mean, not yourself. I mean, drunk.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't go... through a house wall with the gun forward, because the gun would be pushed back on its recoil and damage it. So you'd reverse that if you were to perform that stunt, you know, put the gun through the rear. But yeah, I guess how you could. Yeah, the Germans used to do that in Normandy. But
now, what exactly would you do when you were out crew driving? I mean, it's crew training.
You'd have a commander that would take you out. He would then be looking for sort of terrain. Because the dips, you use the cover to get hull down and just have the turret sitting over, you know, as a viewing position. You would then move from that place to somewhere else to get a view, overview, a higher ground. He was practicing his tactics.
Would you practice tank exercises with other tanks? You know, like
there'd be a few of you, and it built up actually where you have it would be an officer with three or four vehicles, and it would be one would be out to the left and one to the right, and moving forward in an arrow formation, and those sort of exercises, yeah. That would be testing them all, really, all the positions. And that was quite good for that. I can't remember about 6 weeks or whatever we were out there doing that. But in between time, we were firing these Sten guns, a Tommy gun.
Well, let's have a look at that. So your personal weapons. It wasn't the Lee Enfield, was it?
No, it was the pistol.
Well, like pistols first. What's that? Was that the Webley, or did you have anything else?
It was Smith & Wesson.
And what was your pistol training? I mean,
just on ranges, firing at X number of yards, then the next number.
Were you taught how to fire? I mean, did you hold them any particular way?
I did straight out, really. I mean...
You didn't do this business of hold it, supporting the arm with the other arm?
No. None of this Western stuff. In fact, majority you couldn't hit a barn door, you know, I mean...
Well, I was going to ask about that, because, I mean, what range were these pistol ranges?
50 yards.
And could you hit anything yourself? Because you'd been a good rifle shot.
At the smaller ranges, I was quite good. The kick of a pistol, you can understand, goes like that. That's your natural wrist action. So when it kicks, it goes up. So if you had a target, for instance, that picture, you'd only say at the bottom left-hand corner, and you'd probably be up towards the right-hand corner.
Did it give you any confidence that you could hit a person at 20 or 30 yards?
Not particularly, not most. You'd probably throw a brick with more effort, in effect, you know, be honest. You had to be very close to sort of
Did you think it was a useful weapon? Or
well, it felt good, I suppose, having one in your pocket, as it were.
Would you always carry one? I mean, yes, in action. I'll come back to that. I shouldn't have. Now, the others you mentioned were Sten and Thompson. Yeah, they're yes. submachine guns. Did you get both? Or
We practiced with both.
And what did you think of the pair of them? Because they're quite different weapons, aren't they?
Not much. It's chalk and cheese. The Sten gun was a cheap knock-up, really. And it had an awful lot of failings. For instance, if you didn't have the safety on and you had a magazine in and you jumped off the back of a truck and it hit the ground, away it would go. And that used to happen. It was useful, I suppose, short range. I mean, I wouldn't like to rely too much on it, but...
What was its effective range, would you say?
Well, I think you'd be doing about 100 yards out of a thing like that.
Would you prefer it in action to the pistol? I mean...
Oh, yeah, pistol, really. You've got to be... you've got to be in the same room with the pistol, sort of. It was just the feeling that you've got something.
So what about the Thompson then? Because that's a different thing.
Yeah, well, of course, everybody had got this vision of the old gangster sort of. It had a bigger drum, and it was a 45 shot, so it had a hell of an impact if it hit anybody with it. It really would tear a lung out of anybody. They weren't on issue. I mean, but we certainly had them there to practice with.
They had a reputation as being well made, but a bit not very tolerant of things like dirt. Did they jam a lot, or would you not find that in training so much?
Never found that in training, because I suppose they were always clean, you know. I mean,
were you aware of their reputation?
No, not really. I mean, they had the gangster reputation, I suppose. And,
they were heavy as well. Heavy. Were they heavier than the Sten?
Oh, yeah, Sten was very light. Very light. Yeah, it was. But
you preferred the Thompson, or not?
For a fun day, if you like, shooting, yeah. But I wouldn't like a carry-on particularly far. But they were more menacing than in appearance, if you like.
Now, where would... Whichever... I mean, you were apparently... You didn't get the Thompson, but... If you had the Sten, would that be with you in the tank? I mean, was that the idea?
The Sten, sorry. No, you'd only carry your pistol.
So you didn't have any other weapons in the tank?
But, I mean, in the Normandy, I mean, you used to pick them up, and I always used to hang them on the wireless area at the back. Always had something there, just in case.
And the ammunition in the tank? So, any other sorts of training during this six, seven weeks?
No, it went quite quickly.
Did you get to know the crew? I mean, they didn't go with you to the fire to the next
one? No, I didn't. That's the strange thing. You're trained as a crew and then we split up.
Did you get on well with them?
Yes, oh yeah. I don't think, out of all my service in the service. I don't think I rubbed against anybody that I couldn't get on with. No. Some you like better than others, but apart from that, I can't think of anybody, and that's a fact.
Now, at the end of this time, did you feel that you were a properly trained tank gunner and wireless? You were going to be a tech, but, you know, mechanic. Did you feel you were properly trained and ready for the Germans, or how did you feel?
That's very difficult, really. Because you think how far you could go. You could certainly go further with training if you had the time, but I guess time was of a real essence. And they went as far as they could with the time allotted, but having said that, you could have gone a lot further, given the time and the rest of it, which nobody had, I guess. I mean.
At the time, did you think you were trained?
I thought we'd done reasonably well with what we've got and over the period of time. But you don't have battle experience, which
Have they done any? Then they've not done any sort of live firing then. Live firing at you or in the area of you, on the moors or anything.
I didn't do it there. We did it later.
I'll come. So what was your next posting at the? So when would you join them? What month would that be?
That would be just back before Christmas, November, October, something like that.
Did you have a leave in between?
No, I think we went direct to there from Barlow Castle, because we didn't have particularly far to go. So we were still in Yorkshire. I went from the training regiment to the fives, and I was posted to the A squadron, 75th, which was at Radston, just outside Bridlington. And
had they been there long? Do you know?
They had been there a fair while, but already I think one or two squadrons were already in Bridlington. We were all moving into Bridlington, but two had already gone, I think, by the time I joined A squadron. We were about the last to go in.
Now, what were your first impressions on, you know, when you joined them at Rudston, A squadron? How did they take you in to the regiment? They're a Scottish regiment, obviously. And how did they take you in and either make you welcome or otherwise and settle you down into A squadron?
We got off the track, formed up outside the orderly the orderly room, and the squadron leader came out, introduced himself, spoke to all of us. He had a list of who we were, with the sergeant major was there.
Who was it at the time?
Powell. Major Powell. He was Scots. The sergeant major was there, and he's Dave Granger, which of course everybody called Grave Danger. Which is inevitable, wasn't it? But the regiment, you see, was an ex-territorial regiment, so many of the sergeants, corporals, and sergeants, corporals, and up were Scotch, of course, because that's been a territorial unit raised in Dundee and St Andrews and the like. So they were more of the senior people. But you were allocated to a hut and then allocated to a troop.
And which troop were you put in?
Three. And my troop leader was Hall, a Lieutenant Hall.
And what was he?
Can you imagine what his nickname was, can't you? No. Henry. He's, funny enough, his family had a store in Ealing Broadway, not very far from here. And
he wasn't Scottish, then?
No, he wasn't, no. But he was my first troop leader.
And what was he like at that time? Your first impression, so, you know, was he a good officer?
Yeah, he was, yeah. Vicious, you know, I mean, he was an officer, and they come across it that way, they choose to, if you know what I mean. So the initial one was, you were in my troop, and he played the officer role, if you like, but again, the bark and noise wasn't that effective, you know, he's a bit soft under it, and it was quite good.
Did he come off as competent in running this troop?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And did he care about his men, would you say? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I do.
So, a good officer.
Yeah.
And what about the rest of the troop? The troop, would he be the only officer?
The troop leader, yes. And under him, he'd have the troop sergeant. Corporal.
Who was a troop sergeant?
I couldn't tell you.
And were you assigned to a crew straight away, or were you sort of?
I think for a few days we went into Bridlington and were mechanically sort of went through a trade test with a Remy lieutenant. It's a question and answer thing, really. And
testing what exactly?
Mechanical, what you understand about this and that.
Because you were a gunner mechanic at the time, weren't you?
That's right. But you did need to have some mechanical knowledge, and he was testing you on that, really.
How did you do?
It was very basic. Oh, it was easy, really. piece of cotton, you know. But then you were then mustered, as they call it. You were then graded as a gunner mech. Officially, then you join the unit as that. So that was the first stages you needed to go through, but that didn't take long. Then I was in 3 troop, I was in a crew with Corporal Bush, who was my troop commander.
And what was he like?
He was great, lovely lad. Stan Bush, he was a sweaty lad. He must have been about 6 or 7 years older than. I mean, everybody was older than me. I mean, I was still 19 at that point. So virtually everybody was older than me. I think I was the baby of the squadron. But Stan was probably in his 27th, 28th. He was married. He got two little daughters. He was always showing the latest photographs, you know, typical dad, boring everybody, showing you. But he was great. And he was a training journalist, actually. So he was good with words, very quietly spoken. But I thought a lot of Sam, very much so.
And so you were the gunner mechanic, the wireless operator?
Couldn't tell you his name either.
Rest of the crew? Any of them make an impression at the time?
They were all good lads. We got on very well indeed. Previously, I don't remember anybody who could get on with it.
But you don't remember the names now?
No, I can't. No.
And would you go out settling in, training with Stan and the rest of the crew? I mean, in other words, doing what you'd done in Barnard Castle, only with this new crew?
Well, there were schemes that you'd go out on. Yes, you'd go out as a crew then. And these schemes would lead you to take you out, and they'd be practicing tactics and whatever. To the ordinary layman, you didn't understand what it was all about. I mean, there was all sorts of orders flying about on the radio, and people buzzing about left and right, and imaginary targets you would be locating on. But these schemes really were, to the ordinary eye, you'd say they were shambles, but it meant something to somebody.
Would these be Operation Blackcock and Eagle, I think they're called?
Like that. They all had a code name, yeah, and they were always popping up. You'd go out on a scheme for 3 or 4 days, then you'd come back, and then for the next week you'd go out repairing all the walls that you'd knocked down and making good fences and things
like that. You had to actually go and do that?
Oh, yeah. We spent more time doing that than anything else after a scheme. You'd go out and stick somewhere, and I'm not so sure it was all the tanks that did it, but I mean, nevertheless, it was all making good. But you get this. What really comes out is the camaraderie that ordinary people can't understand. On one of those occasions, I was out in this war building, and the vehicle I was with, as the driver got in, his foot slipped off the hub because he had the high bed foot. So you had to put your foot on the hub of the wheel to get climb up. And his foot slipped off of that and hit the valve, air valve, for the tyre. Well, these tyres are run flats anyway. You could do 50 miles on a flat tyre, evidently. But he didn't have a spare. So I had to get in another truck, come back to pick a spare up. The SEER corporal would take a spare up. And I was on guard that night. And you used to get all the gear ready for the day, and there I was flogging about out in the sticks, come back and pick this tyre up to take the wheel back, and when we got back it was really right on the nuppies of time. But my roommates, the lads where we billeted, had got all my gear, was laid out, all polished, somebody else's belt, you know, done up. It was all there ready. There was even something from the cookhouse and all I do is come in and a pair of boots are polished and just get them and go straight on the go. So these things are done natural. They don't have to be sort of pushed or forced, you know. And you appreciate that enormous. It's a strange camaraderie that develops very quickly.